Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. These are strange and uncertain times for just about everybody right now, especially for some of us students. Social distancing means classes canceled, dorms closed, and being stuck back at home with parents again. Alas, for us student podcasters, all of this is not just keeping us apart from the interesting people we interview, but also from the studios and microphones we use to record and edit. With so many obstacles in our path, the easiest thing to do would seem to be ending the podcast indefinitely. But no, not now. As everything else seems to grind to a halt around us, fear not. Real College Podcast continues onward, bringing you a semi-regular podcast produced remotely from our homes to keep your mind occupied for at least a couple minutes today. This is Real College Podcast Quarantine Edition. Stick around. Let's start off with an event from before this all went down. Producer Casey McCabe has more.
In late February, I got the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to attend CPAC, the largest conservative media and political conference in the United States. Little did I know it at the time, but that would be the last time any of us would get on a plane for quite a while. While at CPAC, I was able to hear from prominent conservative journalists and politicians from all over the world. There were, of course, prominent conservative politicians like President Donald Trump and Eduardo Bolsonaro, but there were also journalists from a handful of small foreign independent conservative media organizations like Mr. Alan Santos. While chatting with Mr. Santos about Brazilian politics, he expressed concerns about censorship in Brazil targeting conservative media.
Censorship on the internet is just shutting up one side. Yeah. And that's scary, because that sounds like Cuba, that sounds like China, that sounds like North Korea. And for independent media in Brazil, you just have YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, or a website, a blog, something like that. And it's hard because I need approval from the government if I want to have a radio station or a TV cable channel. Okay, let's put it this way. If you have enough money to build a company to promote jobs and do your job and do journalism, why do you need approval from the government? That doesn't make sense at all.
Santos went on to outline what the conservative movement in Brazil wants from its media and its political system.
What people are asking is for more freedom in Brazil. So more free market, more free trade. We do not want the government saying whatever we want to do. We need to hear them. For a long time, the media was far away from the people, far away from the streets, far away from the schools, far away from the bars. I mean, even the bar, you need to ask people what they think about it.
CPAC hosted a variety of panels, one featuring Jay Aiba, the chairman of the Japanese Conservative Union. Aiba broke down how he sees the current political situation in Japan.
The leftist government, very brutal leftist government, has taken over the country. And for the last 3 years since, the country is spiraling down. It's losing freedom. A lot of journalists, a lot of conservative activists are being jailed. And in every aspect of life, really, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly is being attacked. So we are in a very dire situation. That's why we came to CPAC to learn.
I attended more of these panel meetings, and as the day wore on, I attended a panel featuring Nicolas Santos, a prominent conservative politician from Hungary. During the panel, Santos outlined how he sees the political spectrum of Europe transforming in 2020.
But I can assure you that there is a national conservative revival all across Europe. There are forces, not only political parties, but movements, organizations like mine from Hungary, trying to resist this leftist socialist again.
CPAC 2020 symbolized a coming together of the political right from across the globe. Although the prominent politicians, heads of industry, and journalists all had vastly diverse goals, their message was strong and cohesive. They all demanded more freedom, less regulation, more trade, and opposed any state-run institutions. The conservative message that has been center stage in the United States for the last 4 years is not just here in America. It's global, it's powerful, and it's active. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.
Now, back to the present COVID-19 crisis, where uncertainties about when regular life will resume again are starting to bubble over. Without a treatment, a fast return to regular life seems improbable, and the pressure is on for scientists to figure it out. Ben Hallam has more on one particular treatment.
Hydroxychloroquine. So chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. And it's shown very, very encouraging early results. And we're going to be able to make that drug available almost immediately. And that's where the FDA has been so great. They've gone through the approval process. It's been approved. And they did it. They took it down from many, many months to immediate. So we're going to be able to make
it. If you've been following the news in the last few weeks, you know that the Trump administration has been touting the old malaria drug hydroxychloroquine as a possible cure for the new COVID-19 disease and coronavirus. But we still don't know what effect, if any, this drug could have on the disease. To find out more, researchers have been working in clinics around the world on trials of the drug, one happening right here in the Twin Cities at the University of Minnesota. To find out more about the trial, I spoke to Caleb Skipper, a clinical research fellow here at the U. I started by asking him why scientists think this drug might work.
Let me start by saying this drug was developed in basically the 1950s to be a malaria treatment. And people have noticed it tends to impart an antiviral effect. In the laboratory, so this is not in people, but in the laboratory, it actually inhibited the virus's ability to replicate. And so that is part of the preliminary investigations that give us some hope that this drug may have clinical benefit in people taking it. There's also been a French trial that's come out now in actual COVID-positive patients. And what they found is people who were taking hydroxychloroquine from when they started to shed the virus to when they stopped shedding the virus was faster than if they weren't taking hydroxychloroquine, indicating that possibly the drug had a role in stopping the virus from being able to replicate and shed. But they didn't look at outcome data, and they actually excluded patients who got very sick. And so it's very early data, but those are two pieces of the puzzle of why, you know, this drug is worth investigating.
The trial here at the University of Minnesota works with two groups: people who have been exposed to COVID-19 but have not yet tested positive, and people who have tested positive for COVID-19 but do not yet show severe symptoms.
The trial kind of has two cohorts of patients we're focusing on. First, it are patients who have been exposed to someone who has the novel coronavirus. And these participants were giving a medicine called hydroxychloroquine to them in order to try to prevent them developing disease. We don't know if this will work, but that's what we're doing in the trial. The second cohort of patients is people who have developed symptoms of COVID-19, but who are very early on in the disease process. We're trying to see if by giving them this medication, we can reduce the severity of their disease, i.e. prevent them from going to the hospital. We can keep people from getting sick enough to have to go to the hospital, and particularly sick enough to have to go on a ventilator. Those are resources spared for people who do get really sick or for people who have other critical issues that need those same resources.
For Skipper, this drug, if it works, will be part of a multifaceted approach aimed at flattening the curve by not just preventing infections, but also lowering the resource intensity of treating the disease, because it can be caught in its earlier stages and prevented from reaching severe symptoms.
The big picture is we need a multifaceted approach to this. The ultimate goal would be a vaccine that is basically 100% effective in preventing disease from the virus. That would be great. And we should certainly work towards that. But that's going to take time, if it's even possible at all. And so we need to kind of utilize the other parts of the system. And so we're looking at people who have early disease or no disease yet, but are at high risk, and trying to prevent them from getting really sick. Other people are trying to prevent the infection from spreading at all with the social distancing. I think that, you know, in order to deal with a pandemic and a crisis like this, we likely need to use as many modalities as possible. And so our trial is just adding one piece to the big picture. And with all these things, I think trying to buy time to the development of a vaccine.
Hydroxychloroquine is just one of several drugs being trialed right now at the University of Minnesota to help reduce the severity of the disease and thereby reduce the strain on hospital resources. If you're interested in finding out more about the trial, you can contact covid19@umn.edu, covid@umn.edu. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
While quarantine sucks in a lot of ways, it is creating a lot of time to think, time that can be put towards imagining a better future once we come out on the other end.
Yeah, how's it been going?
Well, it's a time of massive uncertainty, of course, and
that's John, my dad. For him, this pandemic has brought work to a sudden stop.
I also guess that there's going to be kind of a work stoppage for me for maybe a year.
And with the routine of a regular workday gone, he's got plenty of time to sit with old anxieties.
Retirement was always something that was in the distant horizon for me and for us, your mom and I, and it's only receded further out.
If you're not occupied with the immediate health scare, your anxieties right now might be similar to my dad's. Worries about retirement, how to make rent, or where to find a job after graduation. And maybe those anxieties are paired with other sorts of looming anxieties, climate change, or our future in general. Whatever the case, this pandemic is forcing us, all at once, to face our fears. And hopefully, if there is a silver lining here, positioning us to do something about them.
There's an opportunity for just kind of rethinking the way our country or our world does things. And hopefully things improve for the better. It could go the other way.
But how do we go about creating change for the better?
That's the key word. It's imagining.
That's Michael Goldman, professor in sociology and global studies at the University of Minnesota.
You really can't bring about change until you can imagine what the change would look like. And that change, in a sense, is what I think some people are, or many people are, thinking about.
If imagining a better world is an essential first step, Professor Goldman teaches that from healthcare to housing to climate change, changing one central principle can lead us to a world where all these issues are addressed together.
So degrowth is all about not being hostage to the economy and the will of the economy, and in that sense, the will of corporations. And instead, put society in the center. And ask, well, what kind of economy do we want, do we need?
Making society the priority as opposed to the economy is a simple shift, but one that, if implemented, would reshape our everyday lives dramatically. Stuck in our regular day-to-day routines, it'd usually be pretty hard to imagine a kind of world which puts our needs at its center. But quarantine has put nearly all of us worldwide into a kind of altered reality. One that, at least in some areas, values health and human life over work and productivity, making it less of a stretch to imagine a world completely rebuilt with our wellness in mind.
Right now, you know, we don't go out, well, hopefully, we don't go out that much. We only buy what's necessary. And now we're starting to exchange recipes, and we're starting to look deep into our pantry and say, okay, well, how do we make that bean soup that could last for 3 days and be nutritious and not be so wasteful, you know? So we're, the imagination, I think, comes from the material experience of fear, but also sacrifice and spending time together. How do we make do in this crisis? So the crisis becomes an opportunity, and I think the opportunity gets us to imagine.
Imagine how our relationship to work would change if we rebuilt the economy to best serve society. Like under quarantine, everything would need to be valued based on how essential it is to our lives and well-being. For essential workers, this means work continuing as normal, if not increasing.
Because daycares and school is canceled, so they have to be home with their kids and stuff. But other than that, everything's running like full scale.
David Abramson is one of these essential workers at Ward Manufacturing, a company in Illinois that produces small metal parts and has seen an increase in business since quarantine began.
Really, shit was ramping up before it like really hit the fan in the U.S. at least. Because I don't think we were expecting it to hit the fan here. So we got one real big high volume job that used to be made in Italy and is going to be made here. And we got two jobs coming in that are also very high volume that used to be made in China. And both of those are being built right now.
Along with this possible increase in local production of essential goods, essential social workers would become a priority in a society-centered world as well.
So again, you know, if teachers are paid, like doctors, but doctors were paid like teachers, right? And housing was cheap and care was cheap, then you could see that a lot of our needs are being met just through that little circuit.
But of course, for people considered non-essential workers, like my dad, quarantine means little to no work, and transitioning to a world with society at its center could mean something similar.
So if this was a picture of the future, a future degrowth world, I haven't transitioned mentally. It's more stressful.
As Professor Goldman explains, when work subtracts from our relationships, working less is not necessarily a bad thing.
So you can see that kind of obsession and requirement to get enough income to live and to pay for healthcare, pay for schooling, drives us away from relationships. This is a very, you know, antisocial type of economy. Many people have three jobs. How can you take care of your children, your parents, your elderly, or have fun, live life?
So I've never weighed more than I do now.
While my dad has had more time to cook fancy meals and hang out with my brothers during quarantine, without a backup plan, it's been hard to enjoy the time off.
I think if there were a functioning degrowth plan, there'd have to be some comfort in or acceptance in a future with maybe less worries about what's going to happen when I get old or who's going to fund my kids' education.
The idea of a better world with fewer anxieties and risk of crises is, of course, appealing.
I would totally embrace that. I'm not embracing it right now. All I have now is the anxiety of the future and, trying to resuscitate the normal world.
Online talk to organizations that already exist in town.
For now, it's important to imagine a better world and take action where we can, strengthening community on the local level in our day-to-day lives, and supporting local organizations with a common vision. Most importantly, stay busy and don't let those anxieties overwhelm.
I'm staying busy.
That's good.
That's enough pandemic talk for one episode. Now for something totally different, here's student author Emmy Mack reading her piece, Sarah and the Lake.
Sarah and the Lake. Sarah's boyfriend had left for college at the end of August, a good liberal arts school, but he returned in October for good. He was too depressed. It had been a big, drawn-out goodbye that whole summer between him and Sarah, who was only starting her junior year of high school. I didn't see the two of them much. They were always acting like every night was their last together, and staying in at his parents' house to talk or have sex or fight. Occasionally they went out just to kiss and whisper the whole time. They were so into it that I never did get to know Max too well. When Sarah called me that fall to say he had shown up on her doorstep, back from Connecticut suddenly, sobbing, and that she dumped him there for real, I didn't have much to offer besides that it sounded like we should meet up and get drunk if she really wanted to talk the whole affair over. As usual, my mom was watching TV downstairs. This was always a process. I tiptoed past her, dozing off on the couch and into the kitchen, then down into the basement where we kept a milk crate of old liquor. The bottles were dusty and by that point half filled with water. I lifted the last unopened bottle, a glass fifth of Dewar's whiskey, so slowly as not to clink its neighbors. Normally, with white liquor, I would have opened it and poured half into a plastic water bottle. Then I would have used a second bottle of water to replenish the liquor back to the rim, closely inspecting the clear meniscus against the basement's dingy, swinging light bulb. This always resulted in a wavering alcohol content among my smuggled concoctions. But that night, I took the whiskey. Not wanting to dilute its amber color, I decided it was least conspicuous to make off with the whole fifth. I dropped it into my purse and bounded up the steps, draping my jean jacket over the bag to cover the bulge. My mom's eyes opened as I eased out the front door. "I'm going out," I told her. She nodded. "Who are you going to go see?" "Sarah?" My mom didn't like Sarah, because that's where I used to say I was staying whenever I was somewhere I wasn't supposed to be. I was always returning home from a phantom Sarah's house back then, full of hickeys or smoke stink, or just looking like general bleary-eyed death. Really, though, I'd only been to Sarah's house once. Sarah's mom was an intense old-school drunk, the wine kind, who sits at the dining room table and tells her young daughter what a burden she is. The tragic kind, who is still pretty and waxes on about her own loneliness. Lots of times Sarah's mom made her chip in for groceries, even milk, even though the only dollar Sarah ever had to spare was from selling her prescribed Adderall at school. Her mom's boyfriend was no help. He was only in Chicago every other weekend on fake business. His real wife and kids lived in Colorado. His name was Jesse. One time he drove us to get pizza at 4 a.m, and the truck nearly spun out. Sarah was an only child, like me. She was a year older. She also was a poet, which is what I wanted to be then. We had met at tryouts for the slam team. Sarah used to perform her sad poems about sex so confidently. Her eyes would well up and her hands would shake, but she was so good. When I met her, she was secretly sleeping with our favorite senior, and after him, one of his friends. Guys couldn't resist her. First of all, she had huge boobs and was bow-lipped, but she also could talk about anything. Sarah was a loud, long talker. Her voice would teem almost obsessively as she went on about hip-hop or pseudo-psychology or philosophy or whatever it was the boys loved to talk about then. We met Max the spring before, at a poetry slam, when Sarah slithered off the stage. Max went to another school and had come over to congratulate her. Then they fell in love. I stopped seeing Sarah as much, but that had been all right since I had my own boyfriend that summer too, but we broke up in September. "So you're meeting Sarah?" my mom asked. "Well, be careful." She didn't ask many questions, even when she was suspicious. I always thought it was because she was older, 60 back then. Not like Sarah's mom, who was as thin as a teenager. I nodded and softly shut the door. Sarah and I had agreed to meet at the Belmont stop. We liked it there because of all the secondhand stores and fast food shops, plus it was close to the lake, only half a mile or so to the harbor. I naturally drifted east whenever I had nowhere to be, and that night was no different. Descending from the train platform, I hugged my jean jacket to my torso. It was always a little colder by the water. Sarah was only wearing a knee-length dress and an old yellow shawl of her mother's. It was one of the last days you could just wear a dress in Chicago, a fluke 60 degrees, but even 60 is tough when the sun goes down. The day before had hardly scraped 40. I asked Sarah if she'd be all right moving closer to the water, and she swore it was fine. "We'll get warmer once we drink anyways," she said. Turning off the busy street, we cracked the whiskey and chased it with some warm lemonade from Sarah's purse, sticky and left over from the weekend before. I had to hold my nose even with the lemonade, though. The whiskey had a life of its own slipping down my throat. Sarah asked if it was expensive. "It tastes expensive," she said. "No clue. I just grabbed it and ran out the door." "You don't think your parents are going to notice?" "I don't know. I mean, it's covered in dust. My dad, maybe, but No one has noticed anything so far. We split a bag of Halloween M&Ms that Sarah had stolen from Target. The bag was huge and filled with nothing but brown and orange colored. Sarah shoveled them into her mouth as she told me about Max. She said she knew he'd been having trouble at school. They'd been texting a lot, but she had wanted distance once he left. I mean, I'm not trying to stay hung up on some college dude, you know what I mean? She said. She had stopped responding as much, telling him she needed space, and then there he was, just chilling on my porch today like no time's gone by, buzzing the buzzer and trying to kiss me when I come downstairs like we didn't say we were done. Did you guys say you were done? I asked. Well, I mean, we said goodbye enough times, and obviously I'm not going to do long distance, so I tell him that, and then he says college ain't for him and he'll try again next semester. He says he was too sad being away, but I don't know, I just think he's being spoiled. That's a really good school. So, is he really going to stay here? I asked. That's what he says. And you're not going to be with him. I already knew Sarah had had her eye on new guys, so I was surprised when she started to tear up a little. We were at the harbor now, spreading her shawl out along the grass under a street lamp, just across the bike lane from the tall ledge and the lake and its empty bobbing boats. I hugged her, but she held it together anyways, just sniffling. I do love him, she swore, but I think I'm ready to move on, right? I stared at her and wondered what it could be like to be so bold. I wanted to break someone's heart too, but I knew even then that I never would. I wasn't like Sarah. I was always hung up on somebody, always liking them longer and longer. I told her I was jealous that she could choose to do that. It's lucky, dude, I said, and took another swig and raised the bottle. To moving on. We were out of lemonade, but I kept forgetting to hold my nose. We stayed crouched on the shawl for a while longer, the wind whipping our hair against our faces. Our friend Lily had forgotten her disposable Kodak in my purse, and we turned on its flash and finished the roll on each other, my eyes stinging long after each shot. We posed dramatically against the lamppost. Giggling, Sarah pelted me with leftover M&Ms, continually missing my mouth. We kept walking north from the harbor until the concrete ledge became a beach. On the beach, we walked in our socks without shoes. The sand, through my socks, felt like cold clay. Sarah pointed ahead to a far-off flame. It was a small bonfire, and as we walked closer, I saw two men hunched around it. "Hey-o!" Sarah shouted and jogged up to them. I trudged after her, dragging both our purses. The men were young. They had oily ponytails, and one of them was short and handsome. The other was thoroughly average, a little buck-toothed. Sarah sat between them, chatting up a storm. They were line cooks, they explained, at a fancy restaurant downtown. Sarah had heard of it, but not me. The line cooks were drinking wine, and they passed it around. I left my whiskey deep in my purse, though. I didn't want to share. The tall one said he had thrown this little bonfire together in honor of his friend, the short one, who was off to Connecticut in the morning. "He will be in Connecticut indefinitely," slurred the tall one. "No way," Sarah shouted. "Our friend just came back from Connecticut indefinitely." She smacked him on the arm. "No way," the tall one smirked. He and Sarah started kissing, her whole mouth covering his. They collapsed onto each other, falling onto the sand. I looked at the short one, mine, nervously. He had a wispy little mustache. "So why are you leaving?" I asked him. He said he didn't want to talk about it. I said, "Okay, then do you want to make out?" He turned to face me and leaned in an inch before wailing out, "My girlfriend was raped!" He started to cry. I whipped my head around, hoping Sarah heard him, but she was still sucking face across the fire. I touched the short man's knee. "I'm sorry." I still wasn't sure if we were going to make out. "Well, technically she's my ex, but we only just broke up because we didn't want to do long distance, and I thought coming here was a really cool opportunity, you know, they told me I'd make sous chef, and so we only just ended it, and then last night she was..." His voice broke again. He was sobbing now. "On her way home from work. She's in the hospital." Oh, God, okay, I said. I didn't feel like telling him it would all be fine, but I let him lean onto my shoulder for a second longer. I told him that he sounded like a good boyfriend. When he moved to wipe his nose on the sleeve of his coat, I jumped up and kicked Sarah lightly on the back. Time to get out of here, I said, and pulled her up by the collar of her dress. She staggered against me and wrapped one arm around my neck. We kept walking north, and I didn't look back at the line cooks, even though Sarah was waving to them. He was f***ing ugly, she said, when we were out of earshot. Down the shore was a row of small wooden cabanas abandoned for the off-season. We leaned against a stack of canoes. Yours was ugly. Mine was crying. He was crying? Sarah cackled. I didn't bother to explain why. I could hardly keep my eyes open at that point. When she asked if there was any more whiskey, I handed it over. I told her she might as well kill it. I leaned back, and the stack of canoes was tall enough to rest most of my head on. Sarah shook my shoulder. Yeah? I looked at her. She was sucking on the whiskey bottle like a toddler, almost lovingly. I wondered what would happen if I tried to rip it away from her. I had tried that once before. She had cried, and I didn't want any more crying that night. Look, Sarah said, pointing up. The moon, hanging low over the water, was flat on one side. The moon needs a helmet, she said. When I was a baby, my head was flat on one side, so I had to wear a helmet to fix it. Sarah always thought that story was so funny. I was such a fat baby, my mom had said, that the helmet squeezed my cheeks together. Helmet moon, I agreed. Why do you drink? She asked suddenly. Why I drink? She hiccuped and nodded. She was the only person I knew who embodied every drunken, tripping trope. Sarah's liquored body operated like Jesse's doomed truck on a pizza run, spinning in slow motion and full of too much expectation. I drink to get drunk, I said. And why do you kiss? I didn't kiss that guy. But if you did, Sarah's bow lips looked bee-stung. To get screwed, I guess, I said. And Sarah fell into me, kissing so desperately that she slobbered. I shoved her away instinctively, and she toppled into the sand. Then I pulled her up by the collar of her dress again, and we kept walking. I didn't say anything about it, and she didn't apologize, which was all right. I figured if we made it to the next harbor, Montrose, then we could cut through the underpass and head straight to the train. It was time to go home, I was realizing. The underpass near Montrose Harbor was called Tent City back then. It made a good shield from the wind, so lots of people lived crowded into dayglow forts there, especially during the fall. I told Sarah to hurry up. The boat masts in the distance were still about a mile off. Sarah was giggling again. She was looking at the lake. The lake is so sexy, she sighed. You better calm down, I said. We were back on the bike path along the ledge. The lake was indistinctly black that night, rolling again and against its concrete barrier, rolling back out in splashes. The sound slurped. I felt very taken at that moment by the slurping and the mist which brushed against my cheeks. When I turned back to Sarah, her dress was crumpled into a dark pile on the puddled ground. She was using her toes to peel off her Mary Janes. One last jump before the weather turns, she pleaded. She was standing there, naked and white in a pair of thick white panties. That's what everyone did all summer long, walk east and then just jump. Max had lived along the beach, I remembered then, suddenly. The three of us had swam near the same spot in June. I don't remember if I asked her to stop or if secretly I also hoped it might be fun. It seems deranged now to think it ever could have been fun, but I would remember if I had fought her over the jump. I think I was thirsty, too. I know that the bottle was finally empty, and that it was tossed into the water with a succinct plop. It sank, clear, and then gone. And then Sarah jumped after it, and soon my clothes were gone, too, and it was so cold. The water was resentfully cold against my skin, The next thing I recall is all the water in my throat being complete. I jerked my face past the surface tension, and the breath, so slow to come, felt no different than the rest of September or October or whatever horrible time it was. Sarah was choking. She wasn't as strong a swimmer, and as I managed to tread, I wrapped my right arm under her breasts. The ledge reached about 6 feet above our heads, and the next set of ladder rungs were about 40 feet down the path. I tried to use my right hand to hold her head up by the chin. With my left hand, I scooped bitter water back frantically. I tried to kick us forward. I yelled out pitifully. I yelled for help with the rest of the breath I had, and it was still pitiful. Water spilled from Sarah's button nose. A flashlight waved from the bike path. "We're here!" I screamed. I tried to wave, but each time I did, we sunk lower. A dark figure came running to the edge and leaned over. I couldn't see well through all the water, but he instructed me to lift Sarah. I took a gulp of air and submerged myself and used my small strength to push her up from under her back. He pulled out from me, dragged her up by the wrists, letting her back scratch deeply along the crusty corner of the ledge. Then he helped me up too. Sarah lay on the bike path, gurgling. The man who pulled us out was wearing a baseball cap and a polo. His flashlight was attached to his belt by an elastic string. I crossed my arms over my wet stomach, which was goose-bumped, but, I noted proudly, still tan-lined. Sarah was sitting up now, coughing onto the sidewalk between her spread thighs. I stepped over her, toward the man in the baseball cap. The guard, I assumed. He looked handsome in the flickering floodlights of the nearby harbor. He had a short, trim beard. My heart was still racing from the ice-cold lake. "Thank you," I said. I pursed my lips and looked down for a second, swaying. My waterlogged toes were painted red. Then I looked up suddenly and kissed him hard on the mouth. He pushed me right off. He told me to go put some clothes on before he called the police. The wind whistled hard against our wet bodies. I started to cry. "Jesus Christ," he said. Sarah was laid back out on the ground again, dead weight now. She did that when she drank sometimes. He checked Sarah's vitals as I put my shirt on, and my skirt, and my boots. I used the yellow shawl to wipe Sarah down, and then the guard and I struggled to fit Sarah back into her damp dress. We left it unzipped and back and closed my jean jacket around her. Then I called my mom because what else was I going to do? I couldn't maneuver a loaded, wet girl home through Tent City. Sarah's eyes stayed closed, even as she turned her head to drool. The drool was dirty, orange. I told my mom where we were and that Sarah was passed out cold. We waited. Eventually, her headlights came shining across the parking lot on the other side of the harbor. The guard ran to direct her our way. "Please don't tell my mom I tried to kiss you," I said as he started off. He looked like he might gag. When my mom parked, the guard loaded Sarah into the back seat. Then he told us we better all get off park property right then or he'd really make some calls. I buckled into the front. Sarah moaned lightly. I could tell my mom was really worried that Sarah might die in her back seat, but all she said was, "You stink like a damn cowboy." I rolled the window down. At Sarah's building, I got out of the car and buzzed her unit again and again. Her mom came down the stairs eventually and squinted at me. "What's wrong? Did my daughter get too high?" she asked. I pointed to the idling car. My mom had opened the back door of the Jeep so that Sarah's long brown hair was visible, hanging out in knots. Her pale hand, too, draped past her head. Sarah's mom rolled her eyes and disappeared back upstairs. Then Jesse came down, wordlessly, barefoot. He stepped ahead and tossed Sarah over his shoulder like a sack of old laundry. He grabbed her so that she was facing him, her lower body pressed up against his ribs. The way he held her by the back of her knees, her ass stuck out. Her dress was bunched up bad. Sarah's thick cotton underwear looked blindingly white under the street lamp. My mom and I stood against her car and faced Jesse squarely, his tired eyes, trying not to look right at Sarah's ass. It was almost hard not to laugh, though. The panties were frilled along the edges. The street lamp buzzed faintly like flies. "Well, good night," he said. We got back into the car, and it did smell like whiskey and wet leather and bile and Sarah's crap perfume. We drove home slowly and slept. My mom slept on the couch. Our sleep was deep and feverish, and in the morning, my mom told me that the night before could count as my one pass for being totally stupid. Got it? I didn't question her kindness, because this was before anyone I knew had ever drowned. Then she told me to call and check up on Sarah, who said she was just hungover, and swore to me over the phone that she was never going to see Max again. What a relief, I had said. Sarah and I stopped talking after high school ended, but she stayed living in the city in a small apartment with her boyfriend, a guy we met at a party during Sarah's senior year. He seems all right, and as far as I know, she never did see Max again. And no one in my house ever noticed the missing bottle of Dewars, thank God. And years later, my mom would tell me that it was the worst night of her life.
That's all for this episode. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Tosin Fasimo, and Casey McCabe. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online or on RadioK.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.